Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the pictures, what I've left behind. You once again, I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know what you have done.
Good evening, and welcome to the Stop Child Abuse Now show. That's the scan number 2360. Tonight we're having a special guest. Her name is Lori Golden. From San Diego, California, and she is a survivor and a private psychotherapist working with other trauma and abuse survivors. And I'm going to get to her in just a second. First of all, I'm hoping my phone is working right here. But let me, in fact, I'll know how I'll tell that.
Hello?
Hello? Is the phone working?
I don't think so. She was on and then I can hear you.
Yeah, I'm here. I'm still on.
Okay. Our host seems to be having technical difficulties.
Okay. Do you want me to call back?
No, I think if you stay on, I'm going to see if I can get a hold of her and try to figure this out.
Okay.
So hang on a couple moments.
I will.
Hello, hello.
Hello, I'm here.
Okay, can you guys
Hello?
Hear me now? Yes, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay, then we have a show. I don't know what happened. that was weird. I felt like I was talking to myself. I'm not going to touch any of these other phones. I'm going to leave them on, and whichever one of the phones, if it's on my end, okay, I have you on this phone. So we'll go from there. Otherwise, it's Blog Talk. I really don't know. So let me see. Okay, Lori, you're here. You're the guest, correct? You hear me?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, let's go from here then. I don't know if you heard anything that I said or not, but I had said
a little.
Okay, well, let's start over again, okay? Okay, tonight's special guest is Lori Golden. She's from San Diego, California, a survivor and a private psychotherapist working with other trauma and abuse survivors. Lori shares, "I am a survivor of incest." And she goes from there. I'm not going to read your whole bio because I want you to tell your story, okay? But before I do that, we have a nice panel here. I don't know exactly what happened. I do hope that we continue the show. But I do always have to read the mission statement about NASCA, speak a little bit about NASCA, and then we're going to get right into your story. Is that okay?
Yep. It's okay.
Okay. Okay, good. Okay, we have a single purpose at NASCA, and that is to address issues related to child abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent and physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect. And we do so by doing two different things. Number one is educating the public, especially as related to getting over this, the social taboo that we have, this stupid taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, and presenting facts showing child abuse to be a pandemic, and it is a pandemic, worldwide problem that affects everyone. That's number one. Number two is offering hope and healing through numerous PAIRS, providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. Now, that's something I'm very heavy on, is prevention, intervention, and recovery, and I do a lot of speaking engagements on that. Now, tonight, we do have a wonderful guest, and we do have a pretty good panel here. Yeah, we do. We have a nice panel here. Oh, my goodness. Whoa. All right. We've got a huge panel. So you're going to have a lot of people. Well, I don't know if you know how the show runs. What we do is we let you tell your story a little bit, and then I go to the panel, and they may have, a question or a comment that they would like to make as to what you're saying. And you remember, we're educating people here. This is a very important show with education. And at times we do have questions we like to ask, and then we go back to your story, okay? And by the end of the show, you have told your story, and there's a lot of people listening tonight. So this is very good. So let's go to the beginning, okay? Let's start at the beginning. Tell us a little bit about where you came from, what was the first things and that you went through in your life, how old you were when you started to have trauma, from your father and so forth. Go ahead.
Were of incest, and I'm also a recovering drug addict. And my father, I grew up in Merrick, Long Island. And when I think of growing up in Merrick, Long Island, it was a community where things like this don't happen. Everything looked so good on the outside. And I always believed I kind of created in my mind this picture-perfect childhood where everything looked so good, and that my daytime life was completely different from my nighttime life. And in growing up, I had my mother, my sister, who was 4 years older, and my brother, 10 years younger, and, of course, my father. And he abused me from the ages of 5 to 16. And my earliest growing up, we did a lot of things, such as we went snow skiing every weekend in the winter and boating in the summer. My mother was head counselor at a large day camp. We canoed, went on canoeing trips, had archery, we swam. My sister and I went on sailing races. She taught sailing. It was just such a nice exterior, and that's the one I held on to. And at home, nighttime life was drastically different. And I always kind of think of it as when the sun went down, that's when I was filled with terror, hypervigilance, and waiting. And everything in my room when I was younger, my earliest memories, actually, because I had, when I came into drug recovery, I had complete amnesia. I didn't remember anything until I came off of sleeping pills and Valium. And suddenly, I was bombarded by flashbacks. And so my earliest memories was not of my father, but this scary, large ape that lived in the hallway that was only alive at night. And so when I dissociated very quickly in my early life, and I remember as young as 7 and 8 years old, this ape that I was terrified of. And throughout my growing up years, it was the ape, and then it became a man that lived in the attic that was going to get me. But I dissociated completely that the evil in the house was my father. Instead, it was the shadows and the ape and the man as I grew up, you know, got older. So I had ways, very powerful ways, to separate myself from the awfulness. And so my whole life, by the time I was 18, I got into drug addiction. It was my first year in college. I didn't do drugs before that. But once I discovered drugs, that was my, I felt like for the first time I was normal. I felt like it was an answer that I've always been looking for, which was freedom from my pain. And I really didn't know what that pain was. So many things, you know, I wrote a book called My House of Lies, and that really captures what my growing up years were like. It was all a lie. Nothing made sense to me. And I often felt very crazy, and that I was at fault for whatever took place, and that I was somehow bad and normal. I never felt that I never got a chance to truly ask anyone what was for any truth, because I never would get it. So my whole goal in life, honestly, had been seeking the truth for myself. I mean, as far back as I can remember, I remember this feeling inside me of just wanting to know what was true, and I could never get to it. So, you know, and then my whole life, then from 18 until 37, I was heavily involved in drugs. And then,
well, you know, let me
more?
Stop you here. Let me stop you here, Lori, because I do want to go to the panel. Let them say hello to you. And, you know, there's so many of us who turn, you know, to alcohol and drugs because we're trying to get rid of the feelings. And we feel inadequate so often, you know, when we're amongst the so-called normie people, because we feel like we are different. And, you know, we hold this terrible secret inside of us, or we repress it, you know. We don't even know what it is that we're so frightened of. And it's just a horrible feeling. And so I have a big panel here. So I'm going to have them come on and say hello to you and see if they have a question. You've started your story now, and then we'll go on from there. And you're doing a fine job. Thank you so much for coming on, okay? Let me go.
I really appreciate it.
Oh, we're happy to have you. And then we'll talk later on a little bit about your book, okay?
Let
me get Laura on first. Sure, you bet. Laura from Wisconsin. Laura, hi. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you, Carol. How are you doing?
Okay. Do you have a question or a comment that you'd like to make so far? I know it's a little early, but I just want to go through the panel several times.
That's okay. Lori, thank you for coming on the show. We really appreciate it. And welcome to the NASCA family. My question is I've heard the term scapegoat, and I wondered, is that how you felt growing up as kind of the scapegoat of the family, or am I reading into it too far?
No, it wasn't so much that I felt like the scapegoat. I just, when you say the scapegoat, what is it that you mean? Because I know there's a lot of different areas that I could cover in this. So when you say scapegoat,
the definition I understand it as is the one who received kind of the bad end of the family, you know, the one that
kind
was
of like the identified
trouble, or I was the only one in my family who was abused, and I feel like I was the scapegoat because I was the only one out of six kids that was abused. So,
well, interesting enough, in my family, growing up as a child, I didn't know that my brother or my sister were abused, but they actually were.
Wow.
I didn't know it. We all kept it secret. And
see, in my family, they completely deny anything.
Well, my family did too.
Okay.
Everybody denied everything. It wasn't until much later in life when I started confronting the abuse that I grew up in and the incest, and I called services on my father. So my nephew at the time was 14. And so nobody in my family, I was the only one that talked about it. And I was ostracized from the family. I didn't speak to them for many years. And
I can understand
so
that.
Yeah. Until later on, much later, my sister and my brother started having memories.
Oh.
So
no,
when
that's
I say
interesting.
I felt, when I say I felt like I was the bad one, I was the most visible, I was more visible in my family than my brother and my sister. They kind of receded into the background, and I was always fighting. So I was definitely the one where everyone focused on me, and I was the one stirring up trouble. I was the one trying to, I would have rage attacks at my mother, and then I would rage at my father. And I was the one that always looked like I was just crazy and out of control. And in that respect, everybody kind of focused on me to avoid that it was truly a family problem.
I can relate because my family totally ostracized me. I have adopted Nazca as my family.
Yes.
Well,
I understand.
We're glad you're here, Lori. Absolutely. That was a good going back and forth. A lot of information. Thank you for that, Laura. Let me go down to Lisa. Yeah. Let me go down to Lisa here from New York City. Hold on a second. There you go, Lisa.
Holy smoke. Carol. How long has it been? About an hour and 45 minutes.
Probably about that. I know.
Anyway, welcome, Lori, to the show. Welcome. It's good to be back. I've been kind of busy working on the court-ordered rape legislation around the country, and it's good to be back. It's like old home week, and I think we're going to have a few surprises tonight that I know about and no one else knows about. So back to you, Dr. Levine. Take it away.
All right. I'd like to take it away right now, but anyway, we won't go there. I know. Let's go down to Linda from New Jersey. Hold on a second here. Hey, Linda, how you doing?
Hi, Carol. Hi, Lori. Lori, thank you
Hello. So
much for sharing. I read your bio, and I had to come on the panel because every single thing you've gone through and described, I've lived as well. I mean, every detail, the age it started, being my father, when you revealed they ostracized you, I mean, eating disorder, everything you've got listed, it's almost like we're twins. And I can't tell you
yes.
the comfort that brings to know that somebody else understands.
Yes.
So thank you so much.
I mean, that was such a relief for me when I started. I started in 1987 with my memories, and I started in Survivors Incest Anonymous. And what a gift to be able to have a community of people that I could finally tell this ugly, horrible, shameful secret to. It was the most healing thing that I could ever experience. So, being part of it.
No, the repressed memories. Mine were repressed, too, and came back when I went through counseling school. How did yours come back?
it was very interesting because I dropped out of college and then I went back to college. I dropped out of college because I was strung out on drugs. Although I was very good at covering up that I was strung out on drugs, and they didn't really have any in the 1970s. It wasn't the same as obviously as it is now. Nobody identified me as a drug addict, nor did I at that time. And when I went back to school and I got my master, I finished my undergraduate. Then I got my master's degree from Hunter College School of Social Work. And during that time, I wasn't doing drugs. I abstained. I don't know how I did, but I did. And then I got into this profession, and it was not until I got off drugs. It wasn't my learning about college and having a private practice. It was really when I got in off of drugs, and that's when I started having I started feeling an increasing terror where I could not be in my apartment. I was checking the locks. I was checking and rechecking. The shadows were lurking. I felt myself in a house of evil. Nighttime, I felt like once I came in from the day, and I was in my apartment. This is when I moved to San Diego. I did a geographic because I lived in New York City. I had a private practice when I was in New York City. And then I did a geographic and came to San Diego. And then opened up a practice. And during that first year, the nighttime, I was a terrified little girl. And The sun would come up, put on my big girl, you know, I suddenly became the brave Lori, the courageous Lori, who kind of stepped in and went out and kind of lived the day. But at night when I came home, I felt like I was imprisoned. I felt like I was trapped. And it was terrifying. And within 6 months of coming off of drugs, I started having flashbacks. That's when mine started.
Okay. We have someone else we have to go to here. That happens many times. And when people have these terrible flashbacks, thank you for that, Linda. That was a good go-around, too. You know, when you have those terrible flashbacks, it's good if you get help from a therapist, even if you're studying to be a therapist. I know many psychiatrists who need psychiatrists, you know. A lot of people have problems. I know about that. You know, so, but anyway, let me go down to Misty because she's here, and then we have Joe also. So hold on a second. They haven't had a chance yet to speak or to ask you a question.
Okay.
Hold on. Hi, Misty from Arizona. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm glad that, you know, I'm hearing everybody on the panel have good discussion tonight. And it's been a while since I've been on the show, several months, and I had no idea who was going to be on tonight. But, Lori, I really feel a lot of your story because I also was an incest survivor. It wasn't my father. It was my adoptive father. So he was an uncle before he adopted me and was, like, always involved with me. I remember feeling a lot of the feelings you talked about, you know, it being different outside of the house and appearances being different. Up to this day, I have to deal with certain people in the family or old friends I run into telling me, you know, how grateful they are that my aunt and uncle were in our lives and rescued me and my sisters and how wonderful they are because appearances were everything for them.
Yes.
And they were involved in the community in numerous ways up to this day.
Yes.
He never got incarcerated or convicted. So up to this day, he's working with kids in a youth ministry in his hometown. He's working with kids and Girl Scouts. He's working with kids sometimes through the disabled children that my aunt works with, and it kills my heart. You know, but I like you also, you know, my siblings were abused, but I never knew about it at the time, so I identify with that too. For the longest time, I was the only one like you who was seen as rebellious and acting out to the point that I had hospitalization during my teen years and put on different medications and stuff. And really, it was because of the abuse, you know, but I was given all these diagnoses and things because mostly they go by the parents, and they viewed me as like an acting out teenager, like you talked about. So, so much of what you talked about, you know, I think is a part of a lot of our stories, and I'm just glad that you're here talking about that openly because people need to hear it. People that were abused and people that weren't abused need to hear it. They need to know that this is really what happens, that it's so abnormal and feels so abnormal because it is. But when you're going through it, that's all you know. And for us, this unfortunately is kind of normal amongst our own little group.
Oh, absolutely. That it's absolutely normal. And, you know, I know for myself, what was really important in my recovery was stopping my father from having access to my nephew, Gene. I had moved out to San Diego, and I was very close with my niece and nephews. And then when I started to remember, it was so painful to think that my father had access to my sister's house. And she didn't have memories at the time. So she didn't, even though I told her about myself, she didn't know what to believe, because if you don't have memories, it's you can't make sense of it. You can't connect with it. And it was the most terrifying thing for me to fly back to New York. I met with my father. I confronted him, and I told him I'd never see him again. And then I met with my niece and nephews, and the hotel that I had at the time, and I told them growing up being sexually abused and different things that I wanted them to understand about it, and because they knew I was in drug recovery. And he was 14, my niece was 17, and my nephew was 19 at the time. I felt terrified exposing this secret, but it was such an important step for me. And it also was a step where after I called CPS, what was interesting is they focused on my sister being neglectful of her children as opposed to my father having access to her house, of him coming in and coming into the bathroom, and my nephew was taking showers. So my whole family band together. I had 2 years before that I was sexually abused. And when I discovered that she negated that I was sexually abused to Child Protective Services, I called her and I said, I'm not going to be in a relationship with you. I need to be only in relationships with people I can trust right now. And I stopped seeing her for 16 years.
Yeah,
it was really.
You know, sometimes you have to do that. Let me cut in here. Thank you so much for that, Misty. You're getting a little ahead of yourself because you're telling your whole story, and we have a panel, and we do have quite a bit of time left. So I'm going to ask you some pertinent questions in a few minutes. Let me go down. Thank you, Misty. That was great. We're having a good conversation tonight. This is good, and I see everyone feels nice and comfortable, and that's good too. Let me go down to Joe. And Joe, do you have any questions or comments that you'd like to make?
Oh, Thank you. Thank you, Lori, for being on the show. And it sounds like you had you were talking about when you were at home, you was sort of like you were the little child, and then when you were out, you were acting like you were supposed to or something, sort of like compartmentalized your life into those two parts.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
And that's something. And then also about you were feeling that you were bad and that something was wrong with you when you were growing up, right? Because of all of this happening to you.
Yeah.
And so, okay. That's,
No one was admitting their bad behavior. So I guess I was bad.
Yes, and okay, and I'm glad that you found out that it wasn't your fault. And I'll let Darlene have a chance now. Thank you so much for being here.
You're
okay.
So welcome.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for that, Joe. Darlene from Tennessee. Hi, how are you? Do you have any questions or answers that you'd like to ask Lori? Oops. There we go. I know. Do you have any questions you'd like to ask? Yeah, we're here. We're all here. I may not be all here tonight, but go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay, I was going, I got here a little bit late, and then you said, oops, and then it's like, unmuted.
I know. Go ahead. Oh, my God.
Okay. Well, Lori, thank you so much for sharing your story. I know it's difficult discussing about incest because as you put it, I always got it in my book. I put it the shame family secret, so it is a shameful, disgusting secret, you know. But if as long as we keep it a secret and don't talk about it, it's even more disgusting, if you know what I mean. And when we talk about it, it's like we're breaking free. You know what we're, you know what I'm saying?
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah.
So kudos to you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you for that, Darlene. Yeah, you know, a lot of times when we go through this, I too am an incest survivor. Oh, my God, how many of us are on this show tonight are incest survivors? Think about all the people that are listening. And we do have a lot of people listening tonight. There's so many of us out there that are incest survivors.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I remember that when I was in high school, okay, I don't know why this happened. I have no idea why it happened. But these guys were walking behind me. We were on our way to class. And they were chanting, incest, incest, incest is best. And I thought to myself, my God. I felt like turning around and punching them, kicking them, getting rid of them, if you will, because I don't even know what made them say that or what, you know, where their minds are at or whatever, because I didn't know them, okay? So, but those of us who go through, you know, incest, there is so much incest out there. Now we're starting to talk about it, and this is a good thing. We've been talking about it actually for the last couple of years, and but now even more so than ever, because people are starting to free up. That's why I said earlier, everyone is nice and calm, and they seem to be very relaxed. And this is good, because this is when the most information comes out, and we can share best with the public and people you know that are out there listening. You know, this is quite a story we have here, and we have a wonderful guest. And I do want to remind everyone, too, if you have your speaker on your computer, please turn it off, okay? Because that, too, can interfere, you know, with how the show is run. Okay, so let's get back to your story. And there's something that I want to ask you here. Now, you had taken college. In college, you were, you know, doing drugs and all that other stuff, but you were able at times to stop, and I'm really happy about that. And then you did end up joining Narcotics Anonymous for 33 years. You've been in that, and food addiction. You had problems, and this is not uncommon. I want to get that out there also. Food addiction, whether it be bulimia or whether it be anorexia, that too, okay, can be a part of, you know, when children are abused. It comes out and it shows its ugly head. Yeah, it shows its ugly head in all different ways. And tell us a little bit about that. When did you realize that you're having how old were you when you started having problems with the bulimia, say?
Bulimic. I was an exercise bulimic. I didn't throw up, but I exercised, and I remember stealing my mother's diuretics to get rid of water weight. And my brother was, and my sister were bulimic where they threw up. But for me, I was more into exercising. So I can remember trying to read when I was in school in my room at night and feeling, you know, listening to sounds and in the house to hear, you know, be on alert to hear sounds that my father might be making in another part of the house. I always wanted to be in tune with where he was in the house. And I was very scared in my room when I would be studying or reading. And I would run down 3 flights because I was on the 3rd floor. I would grab some ice, run back upstairs, do jumping jacks. And then, you know, this was like my nighttime experience when I was trying to, get safe. I mean, food addiction was wonderful for me because I felt like I could, it was my secret, and I was very obsessed. I was never overweight. I was always very athletic. And I hid behind my athleticism. You know, I was so focused on having a good body that I didn't have to feel my worthlessness and my shame that lived deep down inside me. I was more obsessed about how I looked, feel, how awful I felt. And, you know, I would get caught up in obsessing about food and going back and forth with in my head. If I ate something, I would like start to get anxious, and I don't, just the back and forth, you know, terrible things that I told myself after I ate too much food, and then I'd get into exercising. So it was, it really helped me to not live in my home, in what was going on. It really did. It helped me to survive.
Well, we all look for something. We all look for something, you know, to survive, you know, because that's what we are. We're survivors. And yet we have to find what it is. And we're so often, that's one thing that people don't speak about is the eating disorders. It's more the alcohol and the drugs and sex addictions, all different types of things that we go through. Going out on the street and being out on the street. I was out there. I know what that's like. And all the things that that we turn to because we're running so often, you know, from ourselves and running from the feelings that we have and our racing minds, all these things that go through our minds. And then maybe even looking back, some people, you know, looking back, thinking maybe I could have stopped it, maybe if I hadn't done this or maybe whatever. Maybe I should have tried to tell more people. I tried to tell my mother; she didn't care. And there were other people, that, you know, I tried to tell, and but I was shut up because something would stop me. Maybe shame.
Yeah.
Maybe fear. You know, or being told that I'd get killed. You know, if I did tell.
Right.
So.
Was told. Yeah.
You did too.
Yeah, I was told I'd get when I as I got older. Yes. When I was younger, my father told me that I was so much more special than my mother, and he would really give all these like special words to me, you know, and telling me that my mother, that I was sexier than my mother. I mean, I was a kid. And he would, you know, if my mother knew how much special attention I gave you, she would hate you and she would leave. I mean, he told me all sorts of things growing up. And as I got older, he did say he'd kill me.
How did you, when you were going in school, even in the earlier ages, were you able to make friends? I mean, did you appear to be like the normie kids, and were you able to have friends over? Did they come over to your house?
Yeah.
Did you go to their house? So everything appeared to be normal. Mm-hmm.
Everything appeared to be very normal. And the only thing that would, the only thing that happened when I was in elementary school, I was always in the slowest reading group. And all my friends were really good at reading, too, and they always sent me to the reading teacher. And I grew up with a lot of shame about thinking I'm stupid because I had trouble reading.
Right.
So that was a source of shame for me as well, thinking that I was stupid.
Well, that's too shameful, yeah. And this is what happens so often. We have such low self-esteem that we don't think that we're ever going to be worthy of anyone. How were you with relationships? Were you able to form relationships with men, or did that affect it?
Yes, I was able to, but I was desperate. I was always desperate. Like, I felt like I couldn't live without a man, but it was this desperate need to, you know, stay connected to a man. And when I was in my teens, I remember I would feel completely alone or lonely, and I dress up, and when I remember at 15, and going out and trying to get seen by men, and then I became very promiscuous, you know, in my later years, not in my early years, I was with one boyfriend, but I was always trying to get men's attention. That was like the biggest thing that I could, that took away my worthless feeling, was if I could get a man's attention. And it was insanity. It was addictive. And it was more like sex addiction kind of behavior.
Right. Right, absolutely.
So I had it well.
Well, you know, it's very common. I mean, I was like that too. I might still be like that. I'm not sure. I'm bad. But, you know, it's, you want so badly, I know several people just laughed on that one. I want so badly, I wanted so badly to be accepted, not just by someone who's abusing me sexually in the family, for God's sake. I got abused outside of the family, too. I was kidnapped and raped and all kinds of stuff in New York. I lived in Staten Island. But, still in all.
Oh, I lived in Staten Island.
You did?
I lived in Staten Island.
Oh, my God. I lived in Bull's Head.
Yeah.
I lived in Bull's Head.
No,
I used to go to school in Travis. Where'd you go?
Well, I grew up in Long Island, but I was in Staten Island after my 20s, in my, like, later, you know, like around 22. So I went to Staten Island College.
Okay. All right.
That was my first college that I went to. But anyway.
Well, isn't
so
that funny? It's nice to have someone that was in Staten Island, too. We're always looked down by the rest of New Yorkers because we came from Staten Island.
I know.
That doesn't matter. I know. But it's amazing, and it's sad. Okay, what child abuse does to children. And you had eating disorders, and you for a while you were popping things and so forth, and you did try to commit suicide. I did that too. So many of us do that because we do feel so unworthy, and we do feel so angry. I know that I had terrible anger issues. Did you have anger issues, or were you meek? What type of a person were you during that time?
No. I had tremendous anger issues. I had anger issues. But it's very interesting because I always felt suicidal more so around my mother because I felt like I felt like I hated her so much and didn't know why I hated her, and then I hated myself for hating her. And she seemed like she was such a good parent. Everybody loved my mother. It was very confusing growing up in my family because my mother was like very gregarious. She was very out in the community. She was head counselor at a very large camp, and everybody used to go up and want to talk to my mother about their personal stuff. And, you know, she was one of these people that people were drawn to. And I remember thinking I was so crazy for hating her. And it didn't make sense to me, but I felt suicidal around my mother a lot. I would say my sister tried to commit suicide and my brother tried to commit suicide. So I come from a family where all three of us have.
That's awful. That's awful. It really is.
Self-hatred.
All the children. All the children have been abused, and this is what it does many times. People do become suicidal. I did suffer from suicidal ideations. I mean, I would choose friends that were, I'm sure a lot of people can identify with this. I would choose friends that were less than me, say, because I didn't have to prove myself to them. That's why I was out on the street a lot, you know, not the people on the street are less, but, you know, I didn't have to prove myself. Let's put it that way. And we would sit around and we would talk about how we would, you know, kill ourselves. We were all so miserable.
Yeah.
You know, we came from homes that were very similar. So, we wouldn't talk too much about what happened to us. Like, I would never tell them that my brother was, there was incest going on. With the uncle was bad enough, but with the brother too, I mean, come on. It was too embarrassing, even to share that. So a lot of times we hold all of this inside, and you do feel like you want to explode. I got into it becoming an athlete. I was a runner.
Yeah.
And no one could ever touch me. I ran so fast, you know. I wanted to be like the wind. I wanted to fly away, okay? So these
too.
Are things that
an,
happen
I
to
people. I was an athlete. Yeah.
Well, were you?
Yeah. And I was very much an athlete. And I had all sorts of, to me, movement was freedom. To me, that was, the more I could move, the more freer I felt. So, I was very much into sports, like snow skiing, those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
But
I like motorcycles. I still do. Go ahead. Well, that's fast. Anything fast. Go ahead.
Right, I get it. When you were talking about sharing with friends, I truly did not remember at all. Like, I would talk to friends and share with them what a good family I came from. And I remember describing my childhood in such a nice way, which those things were true, but I completely hid the other parts. And I remember as a teenager waking up and thinking, I'm like a werewolf. Like, I remember waking up. Some of my first memories was of being 15 or 14 and 13 and waking up in the morning and feeling like this disgusting, awful thing was happening. And I had no clue what it was. And I remember thinking it was like I was like a werewolf. You know, like I'd journey out into the night and I'd come back into the morning and I'd be in a different reality. And really, I never remembered, even at that age, that I was abused by my father the night before.
Well, it affects us all different ways, Lori, you know. Like,
I know.
I'm the night owl.
Yeah.
I'm the night owl. But I'm the night owl for a reason, because I don't really want to sleep. You see, a lot of my abuse, and I know that's what it's coming from, happened, before the sun came up, okay?
Yeah.
So I think in my mind, even to this day, I mean, I know what it is. I stay up all night. Hey, I take a lot of phone calls from people who need help, and if I can help them, I help them, whatever, and get them into programs if I can. And I many times would work shift work at hospitals and detox centers and other places like that, mental health clinics, everything, because it didn't bother me. I felt safer being awake in those a.m. hours.
Yes.
I can control that, right? We can control that. Okay, that's how it was with me.
No, my first drug of choice was amphetamines.
Mm-hmm. There
it
you
was
go.
Staying up all night. That was my
yep.
first drug of choice.
Well, I didn't
yeah.
need to take any
I
drugs
relate.
For that. It's just the way I am. let's go to the panel,
yeah.
okay? Because we have a large panel here, and I know they're going to want to ask
yeah.
you questions. So let's go all the way up to the top here, and that would be Lori, okay? Lori, do you have any questions that you'd like to ask or comments that you'd like to make from California? Lori, can you hear me? Your mic is on. That's you.
Are you talking to? Oh, you're
yeah,
talking to
I hit
me.
The wrong one. I hit the wrong button. Okay, let's go to Lisa. She's laughing at me by now. Go ahead, Lisa. You have any questions?
Okay.
I always laugh at you.
I know. I laugh at me too. Isn't that? It's good. Go ahead.
All right. Good. Anyway, hi Joe. Hi Misty. Misty, thank you for coming on the show tonight. It's great to hear your voice. Lori, I have one question for you. You mentioned your parents. If they're still alive, what's your relationship like with them now?
Well, my father died. I never saw him again after I confronted him. He died that was in 1989, and he died mm-hmm. in 1993. And my mother, I brought back into my life. I had my son meet her when he was 9 years old, and I felt I think I wanted to connect with her just to really feel my strength and who I'd become at that point. And my biggest gift was reconnecting with her, because I had never talked with her. I told her when we reconnected that I did not want to ever talk about my history with her, that she was not to ask any questions, that I felt really clear about what had happened. I went through, prior to that, I mean, I went through a solid 8 years, and that's all I did was that recovery, like every day. That's all I did. And I basically, had my relationship with her. She's funny, and there are qualities about her that I can appreciate. I don't ever touch anything that I'll be up against denial. So I stay clear of all of that. What I like is that now my family, when they come to visit in San Diego, we can all kind of be in the same place together, whereas for many years they'd visit my mother and they didn't visit me, because I wasn't involved with my mother for those many years. Mm-hmm. And my sister and I, too, separated, and my brother for many years. So I like that, I can have my niece and my nephews and everybody kind of together, and I'm okay with her now. I don't allow her to, there's nothing I want from her. There's nothing I actually need from her. So I kind of, she'll try to make me, she tries to be manipulative, and she does her like game stuff, but I keep my mouth shut. I don't respond. I don't allow her to make, evoke any feelings in me of really pretty much of anything. I mean, I've learned to detach. I truly have learned to detach from her. So I see her sickness, but I don't have to be in it. That's
well, you know
been
what?
A wonderful
I
gift.
I really like your answer, how you went back to the relationship kind of with all your muscles and your armor, and you walked back into the relationship completely on your terms, and that's really important because you're taking your power back. And I can't remember
yes.
anybody on the show really saying that. That's a really, it's a really clear message. I mean, if you're willing to do it, and sounds like you did it successfully, and it's a great answer. And back to you, Dr. Levine. Thank you. Thank you, Lori.
Okay. Thank you, Lisa.
You're
thank
welcome.
You for that. Yeah. Okay. Linda from New Jersey, what do you have to say? You have a question or a comment?
I have a question.
Lori, I have goosebumps with what you just said about your mother because I just did that after not seeing her for 10 years. And I went through the same exact thing. You can't touch it because you'll go up an aisle. And so I'm just
yes.
waiting for dealing with my brother and his niece and nephew who I was trying to protect. So hopefully they'll get that healing and I'll be able to be in the same place you are. So that's encouraging. And
oh,
I did want to
yeah.
ask one thing about the eating disorder. I had one for a good 25 years. And I suffer the effects now in my teeth, in osteoporosis because of, you know, the non-nutrition. And do you have any after effects? And I want the listeners to know that as well, that when you're engaging in an eating disorder when you're young to get over what you're feeling, there are long-lasting effects. It's not a benign thing. So I just wanted
well,
to ask you that question.
It's interesting because in exercise bulimia, that was my biggest thing. Vomiting actually can be very difficult, very hard on the teeth. And I wasn't exactly, my thing really, by the time I became 18, my focus was on drugs. My sister and my brother kind of did the bulimia where they were binging and vomiting throughout the day. And that really takes a toll on one's body. Starvation takes a toll on one's body. But I don't seem to have, like, long-lasting effects from it. It's very long time that I've been in food recovery. I'd say from my drug recovery is 33 years. When I got into yeah. food recovery 31 years ago, and
wow.
I don't eat sugar, flour, and wheat. And
right.
my food for me has become just loving myself. It's an act
yes.
of self care and love.
Yes.
And I don't binge anymore, and I don't starve myself. I eat three meals. I eat, you know, if I want, like a protein and a fruit at night. But, yes, food can really wreak havoc on the body. Fortunately, it didn't do that to me. And
that's
I don't awful. Know if it's because yeah. for 30 years or 31 years now, I've lived not in the effects of my food addiction. I don't
yeah.
know what, if it was, I mean, it's been a lot of years, me being good with food. So, you know,
mm-hmm.
it's not that
okay.
food doesn't ever cause
okay.
me problems. It does.
Okay.
But I don't do what I used to do.
That's good.
Okay.
It can have a big effect.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for answering that. And that was a good question, Linda. Thank you for that. Let's go on down to Misty from Arizona. I'm going to put her mic on. Here we go. Misty, do you have any questions or comments you'd like to make?
Oh, my gosh, Lori. Like, so much of what you're saying is hitting home. Just for time's sake, to try to limit it to just a couple of thoughts. Yeah, I really remember, you know, what it was like trying to deal with family and the various ways that family have denial.
Yep.
Every time that I've tried to speak up about this in my life over the years, I was always met with some denial in different forms. Like some people would even, you know, acknowledge it to me, but still want to have that relationship with my abusers. And so they would acknowledge it to my face, but if we were all in a group setting, like a family get together, I would be given the option quietly, like, you know, I understand if you feel too uncomfortable to attend, you know, instead of asking my abuser not to come, or instead of the family
yes.
standing up together and saying, we're not going to allow this, and this is awful, and, you know, we don't want this in our life. They would give me the choice to be there or not be there. And that was always hurtful,
yep.
so hurtful, because I felt like my abuse not only was minimized, but I also felt in a way like my relationship with them was dependent upon my, well, it was dependent upon my silence. People that I loved
yeah.
so dearly, people, you know, like my grandmother, who was one of my favorite people my whole life. She never said a hurtful thing, like, or like a spiteful, abusive, mean thing to me my whole life, except that she would choose to be non-confrontational to the point of having my abuser at family get-togethers and giving me that choice. And she never knew how hurtful that was to me.
Mm-hmm.
So for many years, for over a decade, I lived like that until I found NASCA and until I found my voice and until I started deciding for myself, you know, and I'm not saying that this is what other people should decide. I'm saying this is what I decided for myself, that I wasn't going to tolerate that in my life anymore, that I felt like if people left or couldn't handle the truth, you know, that was their choice. And if that meant, as painful as it was, if it meant them walking away and deciding to leave the relationship with me, I allowed it to happen. I grew through the pain of losing that relationship and mourned those relationships. But I moved forward and I found other relationships that were supportive and did not depend on my silence and making me hold on to that shame. So for me, that's how I've moved forward, is I have cut ties with my aunt. I've stopped trying to hold myself guilty for, you know, not allowing her in my life. And my other family, I've allowed them to be in my life if they choose, but if it's conditional, I cut those ties.
Yep. I think
that's
it's great.
Good.
I think
mm-hmm.
it's great.
Very good.
Because
yeah.
there is nothing like really, I really feel like the best gift for me is being able to be truthful. And it doesn't matter to me what anyone else has to say or feel or whatever, as long as I'm in my own truth, I'm okay. And you got to either want to be with me or not, but I don't allow abusive people and people in denial in my family to be, I talk to everyone in my family that I'm strongly connected with now. And, you know, my niece, my nephews, my brother, my sister, we all have been open now about this. And that's the only way I can live in it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's good, actually. It's good that, you know, you're able to have that conversation, you know, with the other family members, and you can talk about it. And, boy, that is one thing that we always advocate, actually, on the show. If people are toxic in your life, no matter who they are, okay, it's
yep.
better to get rid of them, okay, rather than have them pull you down. Because no matter how strong you are as a survivor, okay, and I know this for a fact, if you're with people that are toxic to you, if you don't remove yourself for a couple days or something, I've done that before, it's better to, you know, leave them be, just get away if you can, if you're able to, okay, to do that, because
mm-hmm.
bad things can happen, absolutely. Let me go down to Joe here. Yeah, let me go down to Joe here, and thank you for that, Missy, that was very good. Joe, do you have any questions or comments you'd like to make?
Yes. Thank you again, Lori. You're sharing all your story with us, and I'm hoping you get to the point where you talk about your book, because I'm curious about the awakening that you had, and when this flood of memories came back, how you dealt with it, and who was there to help you with it when you were going through that. And I'm hoping that your book covers a lot of that, so that people who can identify with the abuse you suffered earlier can say, oh, this is how what she went through, and how far it took you. You said awakening from a childhood of sexual abuse. And so they can say, oh, I'm starting to wake up. What did she do? And get some help that way. So I'm looking forward to hearing that part. You're doing so well on explaining everything, and I'm looking forward to hearing about your book.
Yeah, me too. You have really, thank you for that, Joe. You really have explained yourself well. And the one thing we do on this show is we let people, you know, who have so much to say and so much to offer, so that those people out there who don't understand child abuse or don't, you know, understand to the point of being helpful to those that may be in the family who is going through child abuse or whatever, you give them pointers just by, you know, what you're saying here. And you've shown so far that, okay, there was no relationship here, there was relationship here, and now you have a relationship with your other family members, and that's good. It's good that you're able to have gotten that far. And also, too, about toxic people, to get them out of your life. So that's very good, and I thank you for that. Let's go to your book right now, because, we still have 22 minutes left, okay? But according to my computer, if it's right, I don't know. I'm not sure about this one here. But anyway, okay, tell us about My House of Lies, Awakening from a Childhood of Sexual Abuse. Tell us about your book.
Okay. I came out in July, and several years prior to that, I've been working in this field now for, you know, my whole recovery and working with abuse and trauma survivors. And I've had an opportunity with clients, with in support groups, in many different ways to share my story. And, you know, it's interesting. I first thought about writing a book when I started to remember, and I thought, I have to write my story. And that was in 1987, and it wasn't until, I'd say, about, I don't know, 5 years ago that I started really focusing on writing this book. And part of my delay was that I adopted my son at 45. I had had previous miscarriages, and I adopted my son when I was 45. And he's 25 now, and I started realizing a few years ago, okay, I really need to do this next part of my journey in this recovery for myself, which is just to tell my story. And I wanted people to understand how, because there's so much crap out there about repressed memories and how could someone forget, and, you know, there's so much out there around that. And I really wanted to be able to share what it was like growing up and how I was able to repress and not remember a thing and had amnesia, what my drug addiction and coming to my bottom was like, and then really how I started to pursue my incest recovery and everything that I did to help myself get better along the way. And I did many different things. You know, there was a time, you know, people would say to me, when do you remember starting to feel safe at night? Because nighttime is terrifying for me. When I came off of drugs, I had horrible nightmares. I would scream out and wake you know, my at that time I was with someone in recovery. We ended up getting married at that time, but I would be screaming out. I wasn't able to get out of bed to go to the bathroom because I started remembering this evil presence that was surrounding me. I felt like I was lived in a war zone, honestly. And I felt like I was describing my growing up years as living in a war zone, or in, I had a recurring dream of being in shark infested waters in a rowboat at night. And I felt like that captured exactly what my life was like growing up, that there was something circling me, always about to get me. Started remembering, you know, just feeling like I lived in a war zone, like I was hiding behind trees and looking for the unseen enemy at night when I had to go to the bathroom. And it was a terrifying journey, just going to the bathroom.
Yes.
And
hold on a second, Lori. Lori, hold on a second. I don't want Darlene to feel like I forgot her. I didn't forget you. I want her to be able to ask a question, then we're going to get right back to where you are. Because you know what, Lori? No, what you're describing, this terrible, terrible fear that so many of us go through, is so common to us, but not common to other people. So I want to get right back into that. Go ahead, Darlene. I know you have a question or a comment you'd like to make.
Yeah, you forgot me. Yeah, I know you did.
I had bad news today. I had bad news today, so you'll have to forgive me. Okay, go ahead, sweetie. You're here now, so go ahead.
Yeah, you're forgiven.
Thank you.
I know there is so much, you know, that each one of us could take a part of. Just hearing that from all y'all speaking, you know, there's so much we can take into account that has happened to our lives as well. I could never do that before my mother passed away. I tried to talk with her, but as long as she was still toxic, I had to leave, you know, still leaving them out of my lives because they're all toxic. But
yeah.
That's good that your mother listens to you on not bringing nothing up. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, she doesn't listen to anything. I just demand that she not say it. My mother tries to wiggle herself in different ways, and I just don't. I stay quiet. Then I change the subject.
Yeah, I would
because
say,
I don't engage. I won't engage her in anything that I know she's not able to be truthful about. I just won't open
up
anything.
Right.
So.
I look up to you for being strong enough to state what you need and demand what you need. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I look up to you for that because I still fear my family and there wasn't no way I could, you know, you're stronger than I am in regards to that.
It's not so much that I'm stronger than you are. Maybe I just, that seemed to be very important to me in my recovery, was to build the strength that I know I needed and to confront her and to bring her back into my life completely on my terms, what felt okay for me and what doesn't feel okay for me. And I don't allow her to be a part of things that I know she's not going to be honest in. And I don't want to do that to myself. I mean, I don't want to step into her craziness, crazy-making.
The kid that you adopted, the son you adopted, I think you said you adopted a son?
Yeah, at 45.
I can imagine you not wanting that child to stay any time around her that much.
Well, it wasn't so much that...
He could have known now,
what,
you know.
The bottom line is, I had gotten him books on and puppets on. There was a program I got for him on good and bad touching, and I was educating him. And I really shared with him that my father gave me bad touches, and I was always very scared, and my mother didn't come in and tell him to stop. And so when he turned 9, he started asking me more about my mother, and I had just realized I was ready to leave him alone with her, and I didn't, not because I even thought she would do anything to him. It's just, you know, I've been very careful with that. But I think he actually really likes her too. She's good with kids. But the bottom line is she is. Mm-hmm. My niece and nephews really like her, even though they know she's sick in this. So,
isn't that so annoying? Yes. Let me say something here, darling. You know, because it's like they groom. I'm going to use that word, groom. They're able to groom the community and other people. I'm speaking about your mm-hmm. mother here now. My mother would go out and collect for the Red Cross. Oh, everybody thought she was wonderful. And I had to hear this stuff, you know. And I was beaten by her, and she turned her eyes away when my brother would touch me or even touch my friends. You know how lucky he is if he's alive today, and I don't even know it. I don't want to know, okay, that someone didn't pop him off because, he couldn't control himself. And he was 5 years older than me, you know. So, it's amazing how people in the family, and it's much more hurtful too, darling, it's much more hurtful when it's your mother, okay, who knows what's going on. And she doesn't even care. Her answer to me was, when I told her finally about my brother, she knew about all the other stuff I went through. So when I told her about my brother, she just said, oh, things like this happen in families. Well, yes, it does, but it's not supposed to, okay?
Right.
So I think, now, Darlene, I got back to you, so now we're going to get back to Lori.
Okay,
honey, hold on. Let's get back to your, because now the time is going by. We have, my computer's maybe 2 minutes off. It says 11 minutes. I think it's a little less than that. But let's get back to what you're doing today, okay? What exactly, go ahead, talk about that.
What my goals are now at this point in my life is I want to speak and educate. And my book really describes my childhood. I think it's very insightful because I really pieced things together, and I really worked hard on remembering. You know, I felt like I was a jigsaw puzzle when I started, and I had all these pieces spread out on the ground, and I was getting a piece of this, a piece of that. And I didn't have a clue until I got the first memory of incest. I didn't understand how to put these pieces back together. And, I remembered, it's very interesting because in my recovery, there was a point where nothing I did would help me to feel safe. And this was in 1990. And one of my friends and her daughter, who I was seeing in therapy at the time, was murdered by a serial killer. And in the deepest place of inside of me, I felt horrible terror. I couldn't sit still. I couldn't go outside. I was terrified. And that led to me getting a guard dog and a police-trained guard dog from the police units in San Diego. And they failed some of the dogs, and I got a guard family. You know, that guard dog, Fopu, he stayed with me in my recovery. He was such an instrumental part of my healing. I never felt like anyone could sneak up on me again. And when he slept outside my bedroom door, I knew that he truly would kill for me. And it's the only thing that helped me to feel safe. And so my next piece in my journey was I was in the hospital, and I started remembering. I was in an abuse recovery hospitalization, and I started finger painting on large poster board paper. All of a sudden, it opened up to me these memories of how I loved to do art. And I stopped doing art when I was 13. And do you know, up from 13 until the age of 42, I didn't even know that I knew how to draw. No one, I wouldn't have been able to say to anybody, I did art when I was younger. And I started getting information about me from my elementary school. They actually had things to send me. And in one write-up, there was a teacher, Mr. Petey, my sixth grade teacher, said I was talented in music and art. Well, I called him, and he was still alive, and he remembered me, and he told me I used to do really large murals for the class, and I started taking drawing lessons and painting. I started remembering everything I started remembering about myself, I immediately started exploring, and I just more and more connected with my passion, my freedom to just be in my passion and not hide it in shame. And a lot of horrified, terrible memories came up because when we close one door and we shove the abuse behind a locked door, well, we're also shoving in something important about ourselves. And so my recovery has been it's an unfolding of connecting with who I really am and what I really love and the pieces of me that I split off from as I was growing up and never got kind of it pieces that I never was able to pull together. I started doing piano lessons, djembe drumming because I love drumming. You know, all these pieces of myself I was getting back, and I was so grateful that I pursued this recovery and didn't give up, and really I was determined to get to my truth and seek my truth because I felt like without it I was a book with many chapters that were written, that were not even added, like chapter 2 was missing. I felt like I was a book where chapter 2 was missing, chapter 5 was missing, chapter 6 was missing. Suddenly chapter 9 was there. And so piecing my life back together was my number one priority because I knew without that, I'd never be able to be whole. I'd never be able to live the life that I really want to be living. And I really am grateful for that. That was my, and in my recovery, I did Incest Survivors Anonymous. I worked with body, you know, people, deep massage people. I worked with therapists. I was in the hospital twice. I did a lot of work on myself, a lot of journaling. My two closest friends, and I was so grateful that they were in my Narcotics Anonymous program, and the three of us did the abuse recovery together, and she's still my closest friend. And we have, we remind each other of the incredible strength and courage it took to face this. But there's nothing better than knowing who you are. And being
Absolutely.
Able to be honest with who you are. There's nothing better than that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot of people a long time to realize just who they are because they've been beaten down so badly. And you went through a pretty horrific time there, you bet. And today, you sound very much together. You've learned to love yourself. You know you're a person of worth. I always find it I always find it interesting that we are the survivors because we went through all of this hell on earth, okay? And so we're walking, mm-hmm. we're standing, we're telling our story. We realize that we do have talent. I love to sing. I just love to sing. And I sing from the time I get up until the time I go to bed, okay? And been in bands in the past and love that too. And I come from a musical family. Even my mother was musical when she wasn't screaming, okay? But, the point is, we have a lot to offer to other people. Once we get in tune with who we are as a person, then we are able to help other people. And we do come together in that puzzle that you speak about. All those puzzle pieces then fall into place. We have just a couple of minutes left. And what I like to do at the end of the show is I do like to, leave people with hope. Okay, leave people with hope. What would you tell people out there who are, say, in the middle of their healing journey, okay, and or even those who are just starting their healing journey, what would you say to them?
The biggest thing that people have to remember is that you already lived through the awfulness that you're burdened with now. You've already lived through it, and you survived. And I remember thinking, I didn't live through it, but you do live through it. And that seeking the truth is the answer for freedom. Unless you know the truth about yourself, you're always wondering about yourself. And you can't learn to trust yourself when you're not seeking, when you don't know what's true about you. And I really know that it's possible to really get whole. Is as big as this journey seems, there's an end to it. As long as you're willing to walk through it and get the help that you need. But I do know that people have to tell in order to open the door and not be alone behind closed doors with their abuser. You have to tell. That's the first step. And you have to seek help. And you have to be a part of the community and be willing to learn how to share and tell your story. That's why, to me, one of the biggest being able to be in this recovery. But
thank you so much.
I love with people. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do.
You have about 10 seconds left. I have to wrap the show up. But listen, I want to thank you so much for coming on this show. I didn't want to, cut you off there. You've given us so much information, Lori, and thank you so much for coming on. And now that you're a member of the family, okay, you can call in any time that you want to be on the panel as a panelist. So we need people, who have a lot of experience and so forth, to help those who don't, okay, and to help those who need.
I'm in.
Okay, that's good. Good. I'm glad to hear that.
Okay, I'll connect.
Okay. I don't want to cut you off again, so I have to wrap the show up. So thank you so much, and I want to thank the panel. We had a wonderful panel tonight. Thank you so much, and boy, did I need your help tonight. You have no idea, and I'm not going to talk about it on air. But thank you for being here, okay? And Lori, yes, come back again. And to everyone out there, be careful. It's a dangerous world we live in for more reasons than one. And sometimes we find out even more often why it's so dangerous, okay? We have this terrible virus out there, and I have a family member who may be affected. So I'm hurting right now. So anyway, thank you so, so much. We had a wonderful show. And Joe, maybe you'll play the music.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You are forgotten after all that you've done.
Okay. Oh, my